Hello. Thanks very much for this invitation. It's a treat to be here. I haven't been in Berlin in 28 years, and a few things have changed, and it's wonderful to discover some of those. And I'm very pleased to be at this conference. It's a topic on which I've worked quite a bit over the years, and have reached a point where I'm beginning to think retrospectively on the work I've done and the context in which I've done it and the issues that have formed kind of the context of that work. And so I'm calling this talk the Piracy Years. Piracy Years really isn't the kind of, it's not the container for this talk, it's really just a starting point. And for me, it reflects what I think of as an era that began sometime in the early 2000s and that I would argue has ended or is all but over, in which piracy was the main lens through which we thought about what digitization was doing to cultural markets, especially from the perspective of entertainment industries that viewed digitization as a massive threat to all of the sort of commodity chains that organized their work and that organized their revenue models. And so, if you've been around these questions for any length of time, you've surely encountered these kind of apocalyptic visions of the early 2000s, but really extending much beyond that, in which representatives of the major cultural industries assumed that digitization would be the not just the end of their digital models, but not just the end of their business models, but the end of culture altogether in an act of kind of amazing identification of particular entertainment industry models with the larger framework of human culture. And while those had their element of ridiculousness at the time, these were business models that were being profoundly changed, disrupted. It took quite a bit of time for relatively stable digital business models to replace older modes of distribution. And I think we now see what those look like. I mean, at least for the foreseeable future, the distribution model is cloud-based, it's streaming-based. Most of the major cultural industries have made that transition. Some of my recent work has been on the topic of the last of those, really, the industry that is still in a full disruption, and that's scholarly publishing and books more generally. But for the last 5 years, 6 years, somewhere in that ballpark, it's become clearer that that threat was, if not imaginary, at least no longer warranted, that we had come through the period of initial digitization with a set of distribution models and surrounding business models that could sustain investment in cultural activity, and that by most of the available metrics, this was not an era of, this was not a cultural dark age, but rather, I would argue, the golden age of cultural production. And so I just want to try and back that statement up a little bit at the outset and provide a few statistics about why we could think of this as a cultural golden age. If you're looking in music, this will be a familiar story to many of you. The sort of trough of music industry revenues, at least for recorded music, was somewhere in the 2010 to 2012 period, and has since rebounded. If you were to extend this chart back, you'd see a very rapid rise of income into the 1999-2000 period, which is really, the larger chart is more of a hump, and that hump is the kind of bubble of the CD, where the CD revenues dwarfed anything the music industry had experienced before, and then set expectations that it would only go up forever from there. CD, of course, was not a permanent vehicle for distributing music, and when different models have emerged, revenues have bounced back. If you look at the combination of recorded music revenues and live revenues, the live market has exploded, and overall music revenues are higher than they have ever been. If you look at employment, same story, it's at historically high levels. If you look in other media, again, you're just talking about more cultural production, more music, more movies, more scripted television, more books, more employment, more ways of experiencing all of those things. A number of films produced a similar story. Book revenues, just publishing industry, is also at historic highs in terms of revenue and numbers of titles produced. Video games, you know, you can imagine what that market has looked like if you went back before 2000. If you were extended over 30 years, it's just been, you know, a rocket ship up. And if you're to believe these guys who have produced what I think is the most comprehensive account of the distribution of revenues in the music business, artists are also capturing more of a share of music industry revenues than ever before. And largely due to the growth of live performance. So, you know, the recording music industry has always been one in which artists were capturing a single-digit percentage of revenues. So most estimates would put that at around 6 or 7%. But live performance is much more lucrative as a percentage of overall revenues, and as that market has grown, the total share of artist capture of revenues in the music business has grown. And this is what the Citibank report looks like in terms of the division of revenues. So that's sort of the good news picture. To shift a bit toward the bad news, this is from Martin Kretschmer's study of writers' revenues. Martin did a big survey of writers in the UK and looked at sort of the organization of income and the distribution of revenues in that sector and how writers made their livelihoods. This is a chart showing the relative distribution of income across all skilled employees in the UK. And you see it's a bit of a gentle curve, or a gentle deviation from a straight line, which would represent kind of complete equality across all income percentiles. So this is a description of a market with some degree of inequality for skilled employees in general. But if you look at writing, and if you look at cultural markets more generally, you see much stronger forms of inequality in the distribution of revenues across the participants in those marketplaces. And this is, you know, an unfortunate fact of the creative economy in general. It's just a feature of a marketplace in which popularity rewards popularity, and cultural goods are to a considerable degree network goods, in which the fact of being popular means that more people want to consume what your whatever that experience is or that item is. And so it's a market, cultural markets are marketplaces that tend to reward, they tend to be self-reinforcing and to create, you know, winner-take-all markets in which a few products or a few artists will dominate the revenues for the whole market. And there's ample reason to think that the shift toward platforms and sort of the economics of the digital cultural economy just reinforces that further. And the emergence of global markets, where a handful of products are going to be the ones that are marketable across a much wider range of cultures, also reinforces that dynamic. And algorithmic systems that are producing recommendations based on what other people have bought, there's a reinforcing process. And so this has led to a discourse around cultural economies that I think has shifted from piracy as this overarching threat to the creative economy to fairness, where much of the debate about what the platforms should be doing or what artists need is really construed in these terms, rather than the earlier rhetoric of threat, piracy, criminality, danger. And you know, from my perspective, it's one of the considerable ironies and to a degree just a triumph of marketing that the major record labels and industry groups in the music business have succeeded in capturing this rhetoric of fairness on behalf of the entire artistic community, represented by the handful of artists that are at the top of that income distribution spectrum. So the value gap, which if you've been following the copyright debates, and Neva discussed this briefly, the value gap is this kind of strange, or it's the idea that because people are listening to a lot of music and seem to have more access to it and seem to value it a lot, they should be paying more. There's not really any effort to figure out what that means or how much they should be paying, but it's a rhetorical move that the labels put on the, you know, the it's designed to attribute this gap to a specific actor in the music economy. It's to say, well, you know, the new thing here, if there's a value gap, it's really the fault of the platforms. The platforms should be paying more because they're making music more available on terms that are not always easy to quantify in terms of the revenues coming back into the music business. So the value gap was probably the primary argument in favor of the new copyright directive in the EU. It was very effectively advocated, and you know, was probably the most common argument in favor of these filtering requirements. I won't revisit this in any detail, but we're now in the aftermath of that, the passage of that directive, and into the implementation phase, where the main question is, how can you keep this directive from, you know, completely unraveling a lot of the positive aspects of user-generated content that have emerged in the context of the big internet platforms. So the point I'd like to make, just in the second half of this presentation, is to suggest that this question of fairness is a real one. It's an interesting one. It's one that artists are right to be concerned about. It's one that shouldn't be left to the industry groups to monopolize. And it hides a larger question. It hides the general opacity of revenues and attention in cultural marketplaces, both on the part of platforms and on the part of other important intermediaries in the marketplace. So if you're looking at music industry revenues, it's a black box. This is a common complaint of artists. It's something that, in the context of the copyright directive, was blamed largely on the platforms, but it's been chronically true of record industry contracts. It's true of the collective rights management organizations that distribute revenues. It's been the source of complaints for years and years without any significant improvements. This is David Byrne's version from 2015. This is Courtney Love's version from 2000. This is Steve Albini's version from 1991, initially framed in terms of the inability of artists to understand the contracts that they were signing, shifting into an environment in which a lot of these transactions had moved online, and it was very difficult to understand how your work was circulating or being consumed or being experienced, what revenues were coming back into distribution systems like YouTube, and how that money was being distributed and to whom. So the artists would get a check at the end of the month or the quarter, and they'd know more or less how much they were getting paid. And there are issues around making that simpler and more transparent. But there was very little information about the larger cultural economy in which that individual artistic experience took place. And so you could know what you were making, but it was very difficult to know what other people were making or why they were making that. And that, that inability to understand the creative environment in which an artist works or in which you work puts artists at a real disadvantage, both in terms of their negotiations with record companies or in the kinds of contracts that and forms of remuneration that Google is willing to provide or Spotify is willing to provide, and at the level of the platforms themselves, because control of the data has become a strategic advantage. It anchors the control that the platforms have over the marketplace itself. There are other versions of this debate. I mean, the multi-decade struggle for a global registry database for musical rights, and all the variations on that have played out over the years. All the debates around metadata. At some point, these things get solved because they're solvable, and there's quite a bit of energy invested in trying to work them out. But they're also running up against the problem that there are incumbents in these creative ecosystems that don't want those problems solved. Right? They're the people who control the data benefit from proprietary control of the data and work to ensure that those benefits aren't eroded by transparency initiatives, by transparency requirements, by interoperability between systems, by universal sources of metadata that could allow for easier transactions of rights or exit from systems. So proprietary control of data, fragmented data, these are all barriers to entry for new players. And so they serve the interests of many of the cultural incumbents. This argument's been made in the context of the platforms, but it's also true of the other systemically important intermediaries in the creative economy. And that, I think, has been a big missing part of this debate. We've decided that digital platforms are unique actors and the only actors that are kind of important to regulate in addressing some of these questions of fairness in the creative economy. But it's really something that needs to be extended across the economy. So for a while, I've begun to see these problems in terms of data transparency requirements. In part because I've tried to study these issues and found it really difficult just getting data out of any of these companies about even basic things like the organization of attention from country to country, or what kinds of works are uploaded to YouTube, or getting any viewership data out of Netflix. I mean, these companies are all very deliberately black boxes. Many of them are now vertically integrated, so they are both producing content and structuring the marketplace. That's a classic no-no in antitrust law, and it's one that is obscured and allows for forms of control that are invisible because companies are under no requirements to share data. I used to think that a lot of the talk about transparency in these industries was a sign of forward movement. There are always transparency initiatives. I mean, artists are always demanding transparency. Industry groups are always responding with initiatives that are designed to create voluntary mechanisms for, moving towards standard systems of metadata or ensuring that different forms of control or in the case of takedown notices for copyright, these things were visible and in public. But I no longer think that this is really achievable in any kind of voluntary framework. I think there are too many incentives running in the opposite direction. So companies just benefit too much from fragmentation and proprietary control of the data that they use to structure markets. And so I think it just has to be legislated in. And there are bits and pieces of this in the new copyright directive, but it's really an afterthought in a bill that was primarily designed around filtering requirements. You can look at parts of the directive and see questions around data portability and concerns raised about the opacity of recommendation engines. But I think a lot more has to be done to just surface and prioritize mandatory disclosure of data about the structure of the creative economies in which artists work. Until you do that, there's really not much informed basis for trying to squeeze one or the other of these actors. So, are the platforms ripping off artists? Maybe. I wouldn't be surprised in the least. But, what that means and how you can address that really needs to pass through more data disclosure and more analysis than we've been able to do at present. So these are just kind of three suggestions for the kinds of data that you'd want to kind of squeeze out of this ecosystem. Data on revenue, revenue data is maybe the hardest of these things to force the disclosure of. The studies that work on artist revenues or industry revenues are kind of cobbled together from very high-level sources and are very hard to. You can either work at this kind of super high level where you're trying to estimate the size of markets within 10 billion, or you're working at very low levels with kind of surveys or case study-based approaches to artist livelihoods. It's very hard to work at the intermediate level where you're looking at, questions of, categories of artists or, the relative efficiency of different organizations in distributing revenues, like collective rights management organizations. So this whole middle layer is really what you need to understand what you need to be able to get at in order to, understand how to regulate or how to move from one service to another. Would I be doing better, moving my content from YouTube to other video distribution services, or from Spotify to some potential set of competitors. And you're relying on the companies to tell you that, and they of course have an interest in obscuring that information. So there are lots of areas in which a data transparency agenda really should be, I think, it should precede a lot of the stronger, more applied regulatory approaches to get these companies to do things differently. I will leave it there just because I know we're a little pressed for time, and just suggest that one of the attractions of this to me is that I think all of the systemic players in these ecosystems would hate it. I think it's a nice way of changing the kind of dilemma of content versus platforms as the kind of primary political cleavage in this debate. And having been around these debates for, you know, quite a while now, that's a very strong and, I think, interested way of constructing the debate. It's useful for both sets of parties to pretend there's a strong political difference between the interests of the platforms and the interests of the content holders. I really don't think that's true. I think their roles in these ecosystems are, as Neva said earlier, increasingly defined by control of data, and that if you want to piss both of them off and make some progress on fairness and artists' rights, you have to start prying loose that data. Thank you. Sure, I'm happy to take questions.
Yeah, I'm still trying to process a good formulation of a question to you, but I felt like it's a really soft approach in addressing the obscenity of the inequalities that are happening with the digital environments that have captured so much of the livelihoods that are possible out of making culture. And so this digitization process has really found a way to consolidate so much power over our cultural production in our society. And I don't know, I just feel like there has to be much more confrontation of these corporate players who have created this titan control lockdown of our culture, and how are we going to break that up? I mean, we have to break up these monopolies more than just through data transparency. I mean, the internet is moving towards, the whole economy of the internet is about scooping up data and making that a profitable thing. And that's a really dangerous thing in terms of surveillance and the powers that give to these titans. So I don't know where to start. It just feels like you've missed so much about how it's kind of the dark age of what's happening in terms of data control and the disappearance of livelihoods in cultural production.
Well, I guess I'll take that last part of your statement as a question. And I think if you're looking at the perspective of the implications of the control of data, there are lots of things to worry about. And you know, that's part of where I'm going with some of these ideas around transparency. I started with the question of just very crude measures of production and revenue. And I do think that, despite the fact that there are many independent artists don't benefit from this this kind of influx of money and struggle to sustain their work, I think that's we've just spent a couple days talking about ways to increase the sustainability of artists' livelihoods. The data transparency issue is inevitably a bit tangential to that, although I think it is an important precondition, where the more artists can understand about the systems in which they work, the more agency they will have in changing, exiting if the terms are unfavorable. And we need to increase the agency of artists to work within these systems as well. So I think that the data transparency issues are a step on that path.
(Clears throat) Well, thank you for your talk. It was very interesting. My question would be: do you have any concrete ideas how to get more transparency, perhaps even in the context of Article 17 of the DSM directive? And what do you think? Who should be the actor of to get this information? Perhaps not the single artists. Perhaps organizations of creators, or do we need new bodies to get this information? Public bodies, private bodies. Do you have any ideas in this direction? Thank you.
Well, if you begin with legislative mandates or administrative mandates derived from things like Article 17, then there could be a number of different actors responsible for that kind of data collection. But if YouTube were required, I mean, most of these companies publish some sort of report on their activities, and they do so in the context of a mix of voluntary and mandatory requirements around what they have to disclose in order to be a legally operating entity in good standing with a variety of different authorities, tax authorities. That range of obligations could be expanded. So it could include, especially in the context of companies that are working both as producers of cultural cultural works and distributors. Netflix, I mean, Spotify is now beginning to move into the label business where they're directly representing artists. That's a classic problem of vertical integration that there have been plenty of legal strategies and government agencies that have taken some responsibility for ensuring that there's enough information available to determine whether that's not in the public benefit. And so I think in some cases there's a lengthy history of strategies that could be applied in this context. We're just not really we're just not used to applying them in these contexts. So antitrust strategies is one, and I think there are both positive and negative ways to think about that in terms of what that might imply for some of these large conglomerates. I think some of the focus on breaking up some of the big companies doesn't clearly identify what would be achieved by breaking them up. So it'd be possible to break up Facebook, it'd be possible to break up Google, but you might not address some of the concerns that were the source of some of that antitrust intention. I'm not sure that's answered your question, but is that close enough? I also don't want to run out the clock and squeeze the other speakers. Thank you.